At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Alliances take a very, very long time to form, but minutes or days to shatter.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, Bulwark contributor. My normal partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and contributing writer to The Atlantic, is traveling. He will be back with me, though, I think, to discuss some of the jackassery that's gone on today at Quantico, where the Secretary of Defense and the President seem to have wanted to make the U.S. military safe for hazing again. We'll get into that. But today, I have the privilege of having Tim Bouverie, who's a former Alistair Horn Fellow at St. Anthony's at Oxford and a historian who has written a new book, Allies at War, which covers how the struggles between the Allied powers shaped the war in the world. Tim, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Thank you for having me, Eric. It's great to be here.
I loved your book, as I mentioned in the green room, as a former practitioner and a lapsed diplomatic historian. I found it a fascinating and entertaining read, and I learned a lot from it, and it's a subject I know a bit about. I wonder, you know, G.M. Young in Victorian England, Portrait of an Age, famously said that diplomatic history is the story of what one clerk wrote to another. Obviously, you kind of have a different view, and the book is a kind of marvelous account of the interplay of both personalities and the foibles of great personalities, as well as the larger forces at play. It takes the personalities seriously and does not ascribe to them what A.J.P. Taylor once said, which is, I think most great men were there for the beer. So what brought you to write this book?
The book came as a sort of natural sequel out of the first book I wrote, which was on appeasement and the politics of the 1930s in international affairs. Like you and like many of your listeners, I'd read a lot of books about the Second World War, many marvelous military histories. But there seemed to be, in my reading, too much of an abrupt gear change, the sort of assumption that as soon as war is declared in September of 1939, that this purely becomes a story of tanks and Tommies, aeroplanes and espionage, and the politics is forgotten. But politics carried on throughout the Second World War, and politics was absolutely vital, not only to the war and the way the war developed, but to the post-war world and the world in which we have lived right up to the present. If we look at the most fundamental macro level, the only reason why Adolf Hitler, Benito Mussolini, and imperialist militarist governments of Japan did not triumph between 1939 and 1945 is because they were confronted by a superior coalition of nations and empires that combined their resources and coordinated their plans in order to thwart them. And that may sound very simple, and because we know about the British-American-Soviet collaboration during the war, we know about the much romanticized relationship between Churchill and Roosevelt during the war, this can appear axiomatic. But it really wasn't. The anti-Axis alliance was in no way inevitable. In fact, it was distinctly improbable. It was not the alliance that was meant to win the war. It was not the alliance that was meant to defeat Hitler. And then after, when it was formed in 1941, it continued to function in a way that naturally produced tensions. There were tensions between the different powers who had different ideological aims, different military aims, different strategic aims, different post-war aims. And yet for each power, there was also an inner tension and an inner tension with the alliance between military expediency on the one hand and long-term political goals and principles on the other. So that was the ambition of my book, to really try and explore all of that. And when you come to the famous quotation by G.M. Young about diplomatic history being what one clerk says to another, my ambition was to try and dig below the level of the big three or the main, most famous allied players to discover what one clerk said to another, because it's only by doing so that you realize how out there on a limb certain diplomatic or political strategies were that Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin, de Gaulle were advocating, or were they following advice? Were they following the consensus? To what extent did any of these people and more detached observers, like the clerks and attaches and ambassadors in the Foreign Office, see themselves as independent historical agents, or did they feel that they were being pushed around on some vast global strategic chessboard by vast impersonal historical forces? And that is, I think, worthy of study, and it's a conundrum which historians should take seriously.
Yeah, and one of the things that I admired about this is, you know, Elliot and I normally regard ourselves as Churchillians, and you know, I yield to few people in my admiration for Churchill. But because of my own work in this field, I'm also painfully aware of the degree to which he was quite emotional. His judgment was not always perfect. In fact, some of his judgments led to, you know, a variety of, in the First World War, large-scale disasters, and in the Second World War, some, you know, disasters that may be not quite as dramatic, but still, you talk about them in Greece and elsewhere, and was constantly trying, or constantly being reined in by his subordinates, and not just Sir Anthony Eden. And by the way, I'd love to talk about that, because I think Eden, whose reputation frequently suffers because of the role he played as prime minister at Suez, I think actually emerges from your book, tell me if I'm wrong or misreading you, as actually a very good foreign secretary who more often than not was, you know, more correct in some of his judgments than Churchill was. But others in the Foreign Office, Foreign and Colonial Office, including notably the permanent undersecretary, Sir Alexander Cadogan, whose diary you used, I actually used it in my dissertation as well. You know, they were trying to rein some of Churchill's, you know, more extravagant enthusiasms, I would say, from a strategic point of view in. Am I misreading you on that?
No, certainly not. Churchill was regarded as a dangerous emotional adventurer, and this had led to a succession of disasters, the most well-known being Gallipoli, although there is a fairly strong historical counterfactual that Churchill was actually right about Gallipoli. The implementation was what went wrong. But thereafter, putting Britain back on the gold standard, opposition to self-government for India, support for Edward VIII during the abdication, trying to send many more British troops than actually did go to fight in the Russian Civil War. This was a volatile character, and yet he had redeemed his reputation to a great extent by the later 30s by being so consistently right, and right so early, about the danger posed by Nazi Germany, which was the subject of my first book. And then he was right often in the Second World War as well. And Anthony Eden was not always right. Anthony Eden in 1941 suggested that the British should acknowledge the Baltic states as being part of Soviet Russia as per Stalin's demands. And it is Churchill who pushes back and says, absolutely not. These conquests which Stalin has gained are those that he got through shameful collaboration with Hitler, and we are not going to enhance our position in the world, certainly not with the Americans, if we start making those sorts of deals. So it's not by any means solely right to say that Eden was often right on foreign policy and Churchill was wrong. It's Anthony Eden who ultimately makes the final call to send the British Expeditionary Force to Greece, which I think was right politically, but as most people thought, a disaster militarily in 1941. They worked well. Churchill was bolder. Eden was probably at his best as Foreign Secretary, but he was very indecisive. He was a tortured soul in many cases, who worked himself to death and helped worry himself into constant illnesses. And I think that one can see the seeds of what went wrong in his premiership in some of his wartime manifestations.
I do want to talk a little bit. I want to talk about the big three diplomacy a little bit later. But before we turn to some of the, I think, really unique contributions of your book, I want to talk a little bit about, if you don't mind, the Churchill-Roosevelt relationship, because that is sort of a major thread, I would say, of your book. And it's, you know, it's a well-documented relationship, certainly in terms of the primary source material, much of which has now been published in terms of their correspondence and how they saw things. Talk a little bit about the nature of that relationship. And one of the things that I think you do so well in the book is talk about how the shifting balance of power over the course of the war changes the nature of the FDR Churchill relationship. I mean, my take a little bit from your book is that Churchill certainly comes to the U.S. after, even before Pearl Harbor and the Russian or the German declaration of war in the U.S., he already has a conception of the strategy for the war. FDR is a little vaguer about his strategic view, although he clearly is committed to Europe first rather than fighting in the Far East, which requires him to override his military in multiple times. But my sense is that FDR throughout wanted to postpone as much as possible any political decisions about the future of Europe and the world, the global order, until the war was over, and that military necessity was by and large what drove him, whereas Churchill was much more willing to countenance efforts to kind of shape things a little bit, including the percentages deal. I think that's where you kind of get the percentages deal in 1944 between Churchill and Stalin to try and rein in the Soviets in Eastern Europe when it's pretty clear they're going to be the dominant force. Talk a little bit about the relationship between the two leaders.
Well, in many ways, it's a relationship which shouldn't have flourished on a personal level. These are two very different personalities, apart from a shared love of history and fairly healthy, I would actually argue, over healthy egos, as well as being patricians. I think FDR is an extremely complex character. He's easily the most complicated character of all of the Allied leaders. I believe that pretty much everything you can say about Franklin Roosevelt, you can also say the direct opposite. He was ostensibly warm and straightforward, and yet he was also cold and devious. He was fantastically charming and a consummate politician, and yet he could also be quite cruel to his allies and indeed his friends. He was one of the great idealists of the 20th century, and yet he was also utterly ruthless and at times a dreadful cynic. And he had, on the domestic front, a great and genuine compassion for the destitute and the suffering, but combined this with, frankly, a fetish for European royalty and aristocrats, many of whom either visited America or were in exile in the US during the Second World War. So he's a very, very complex character, and almost the closer you get to him, the further you have to go, or the more he eludes you. I think there was a genuine friendship and respect between Churchill and Roosevelt, but it was not linear. It was one that peaked in the winter of 1942 to 1943. Up till that point, Roosevelt was happy to defer to Churchill in matters of grand strategy, because Churchill had a strong sense of grand strategy, and to a limited extent, Roosevelt agreed with it. He agreed with Europe first. And if it couldn't be France, where the British were absolutely adamant an invasion was impossible before 1944, and I think they were probably right. We only have to see what happened when the British and the Canadians tried a raid on the French port of Dieppe in August of 1942 to see what a disaster a premature attack across the Channel would have been. But thereafter, we see the relationship moving increasingly apart. And part of this is not to do with personality at all. Part of this is to do with the great sleeping giant of America, as the Japanese famously put it, waking up, this enormous industrial power, mobilizing its resources and its arms and asserting itself. Thereafter, the US military is far less prepared to play second fiddle to the British, and Roosevelt is not prepared to defer to Churchill to such an extent. He is, I think, jealous of Churchill's ability to move around the world, something which, due to the physical position of the United States and his own physical impediments, is denied to him. And thereafter, we see him trying to cement his own relationship with Stalin and the United States' relationship with the Soviet Union at the expense of the British. And I am very critical of this. I think that it was not necessary for him to try and curry favor with Stalin at the expense of Churchill and the British. All he did, because he certainly didn't gain any strategic or political advantages from this strategy, was to show Stalin that the democracies could be divided. And at a time when the Red Army was so assertive in Europe and was obviously going to play a dominant part in Eastern Europe, I think it was a great mistake. He wasn't always naive. There are some really shocking moments of cynicism where he admits very privately to individuals that he realizes that Eastern Europe is going to be communized. And yet he sort of still seems to think that he, this unbelievably talented politician who's won the presidency by this stage thrice, if not four times, will be able to preside at some great wartime conference at the end of hostilities, a bit like the Treaty of Versailles, but with this time the guarantee that the Americas are going to get to stick around and see the peace through. And at that moment, a combination of his own political skill and American financial power, American economic largesse to the war-torn countries of Europe and the destitute Soviet Union will allow him to configure the chess pieces as he wishes. The naivety of that is not only failing to appreciate Stalin's aims, but also that once the Red Army has asserted itself in wherever it may be, in either Eastern Europe or the Balkans, it's going to be very hard to get them out. And it is that sense of panic and that realization that sends Churchill to Stalin in October of 1944 to try and save Greece. The percentages agreement whereby the British Prime Minister and Stalin decided what percentage of influence each was going to have in the Balkan countries has been hugely controversial and condemned by historians right up to the present. But I think it can be explained much more simply and indeed admirably, in that it is Churchill surrendering what was already lost, Romania, Yugoslavia, Hungary, what was already going into the Soviet sphere, in order to bargain with Stalin to save Greece for the Western democratic sphere. And in that, I think he succeeded.
Right. I mean, he gets a free hand, essentially, from Stalin, who on multiple occasions notes that in his conversations. I mean, one of the things you're just hitting on, Tim, is something I've observed in my misspent youth in government, which is that political leaders, in my experience, have an outsized view of what they can personally accomplish with their counterparts. President George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, used to say all the time to some of his advisors when they would disagree with him, if you're so smart, how come you're not president of the United States? I mean, these are people who have climbed to the top of, you know, a political system, using their intellect, their other interpersonal skills, and they understandably come to believe that they have a, you know, some high level of ability in that. They're not, you know, wrong in that in most cases. And FDR, as you were just saying, it seems to me, consistently underestimated the degree to which Stalin was a highly motivated ideologue. That's something that I think actually comes out very strongly in Stephen Kotkin's biography of Stalin, that this was a man who was deeply Marxist-Leninist in the most fundamental sense, and that the idea that he was going to be charmed and taken off his view of what Soviet national interests were was misbegotten. And there's some of that, by the way, in among the Brits as well, until fairly late in the war, that there's maybe a way to persuade Stalin to, you know, not do this, that, or the other thing.
Well, I completely agree. And this is a constant theme of foreign policy. It was the undoing of Neville Chamberlain, the subject of my first book, who believed that he had gained some influence over Hitler. And when Churchill returns from the Yalta conference, he says to his cabinet colleagues, poor Neville, he thought he could trust Hitler, but I don't think I'm wrong about Stalin. Now, that is one devastating quotation about Churchill, but that has to be set in context of many other quotations at the same time where Churchill suggests that there is nothing he can do to prevent Eastern Europe from being Bolshevized, and that he is very clear-sighted about Stalin and the Soviet threat. Churchill is an emotional character, and when he feels that something has gone well, or when he's trying to persuade himself that things aren't so awful as they were, and the idea that Britain and the United States might be engaged in another war against their wartime ally mere days after the almost end of the Second World War is completely unthinkable. But I think FDR certainly overestimated his personal and diplomatic ability. I don't think that Stalin was ever influenced by a foreign leader, and very rarely at all was Hitler. People have to realize that others have climbed to the top of their states, and not only do they consider themselves to be hugely talented and efficient politicians, but they are guided overwhelmingly by their own national interests. The one possible exception to this would be the current US president, who places a premium on his own personal standing and the levels of respect he is accorded, not just by foreign dignitaries and leaders, but by others, to a far greater extent than any US leader in history before. So there, I might say there is an exception, but broadly, most foreign leaders overestimate the impact of personal diplomacy.
Yeah, let's come back to, we can come back to the current US leader and the flattery to which he aspires and has in many ways succeeded. I want to talk about one of the things that I think is one of the real major contributions that your book makes to the historiography of diplomacy during World War II, and that is to not just look at the Anglo-American relationship or the Big Three, which we can come back to, but to the relations among smaller allies. So the book really opens in many ways with an account of Anglo-French relations as France is falling and after the fall of France, including the British attack on the French fleet in North Africa. A lot of discussion of the relationship over the course of the book with Charles de Gaulle and the Free French and the efforts to create a kind of a French, an independent French committee that unites all the different elements of non-Vichy France, including some former Vichy elements. I would say, by the way, just inter alia, I think you're a little harsh on one of my heroes, Robert Murphy, who was the U.S. chargé d'affaires in Vichy France and was executing Roosevelt's policy of continuing relations with Vichy in an effort to try and keep the Germans from completely occupying France. It failed, but in my estimation, again, looking as they were looking forward, not with hindsight that we have, it was a gamble worth taking, but that's a small cavil. But you also have a very interesting account of the efforts of Sir Samuel Hoare, who I think I would say fairly a reviled foreign secretary for his role in appeasing Mussolini in the 1930s, but who as ambassador to, you know, as His Majesty's ambassador to Spain, has a real virtuoso role in your book in keeping Spain out of the war and neutral, which was extremely important, as well as British efforts to get Turkey on the other end of the Mediterranean into the war, which were not successful, and the ongoing efforts to deal with Greece over the entirety of the war, as well as Anglo-Russian relations before the U.S. entry into war. Because those are extremely important. And even after the U.S. entry into war, you talk a lot about Sir Anthony Eden's negotiation of the Anglo-Soviet Treaty of 1942, which at the time, both he and Churchill believed was meant to be the sort of cornerstone of Britain's post-war relationship with the Soviet Union, although, of course, doesn't turn out that way. So talk a little bit about that and why you focused on that and what you found from examining those episodes that really don't normally get as much attention as you devote to them.
Well, I think it's precisely because of that that I wanted to put them in the book. The Anglo-French alliance and the role played by France both before and after the German conquest is critical. This was the alliance that was meant to win the war. This was the alliance that had held the Germans for 4 years on the Western Front between 1914 and 1918, and nobody expected the French to collapse in 6 weeks, including Hitler. So I think it is really, really important if we are looking at pivotal moments, if we have to think of what is the pivotal moment of the 20th century, it is probably the fall of France. It is the fall of France that upsets the entire strategic calculus and somehow then makes a German invasion of the Soviet Union much more likely and potentially makes American involvement in the European war much more likely. So I think it's absolutely critical to understand how that alliance disintegrated, why it's disintegrated, and also what then happens to that alliance, because the French do not just exit stage left pursued by a bear, as in The Winter's Tale. They are still involved, but they are bifurcated. There is the Vichy element, where you alluded to the diplomacy of Robert Murphy, and it's very much, as you say, the instructions he is getting from Cordell Hull and the States Department and the Roosevelt administration, which in a, I think, fairly extraordinary manner and a naive manner continued to recognize the Vichy regime right up until its collapse in November of 1942 and placed Dahle, the former prime minister of Vichy and an arch collaborator with Hitler, in authority in North Africa by chance. This causes huge consternation across the allied pro-democratic and neutral world.
And in the United States, where it was politically very, very controversial and not popular.
Well, absolutely. And this is something which is a theme of the book that I keep on stressing, is it is much harder for the democracies in a way to wage this sort of war because they have to take account of public opinion. Public opinion is critical. And one of the reasons I talk about military events prior to the American entry, anything that the British do is based largely on how will this help us survive and how will this help America come into the war? And so if I was just to identify one single sheet of paper, which I was most excited to find during my research, it's a one-line telegram which I came across in the FDR Presidential Library at Hyde Park on the Hudson, which was from the 4th of July 1940, the day after the British had sunk a considerable proportion of the French fleet off the North African coast. And this was, and is typically portrayed as, a military necessity, a desire to prevent the French fleet from falling into the hands of the Germans and therefore facilitating an invasion of the British Isles. But at the same time, it was a political action designed to show that the Americans, that the British were prepared to do anything to survive, and therefore were not going the way of France. They were not going to capitulate, and therefore the US had to send Britain very substantial military aid, which up until that point had not been forthcoming. But nobody had ever suggested before that the British had actually asked the Roosevelt administration for their permission to sink the French fleet. But this telegram from the British ambassador Lord Lothian to FDR read, "Mr. President, you will see that Winston Churchill has taken the action with regard to the French fleet, which we discussed and you approved." And I think that is very, very telling. Similarly, British intervention in Greece in 1941 is overwhelmingly conditioned upon how it will look if Britain abandons its ally, a democratic ally, Greece, an ally to whom Britain had given a guarantee of defence in the event of unprovoked attack in March of 1939. So these powers and these otherwise considered sideshows, I argue, are not sideshows. What is one of the most consistent areas of disagreement between the British and the Americans during the war? It is the role of the Free French and the role of General de Gaulle. And although Churchill finds de Gaulle absolutely infuriating, it is Churchill that always insists, against the protestations of Roosevelt and Stalin, that France be reconstituted as a major power. The Americans were very indifferent to this project, and it is Churchill who allows the Free French to take part in the Battle of France in 1944 after the initial D-Day assault. It is Churchill who insists that France be an occupying power of Germany at the end of the war. And it's Churchill that insists that France be a permanent member of the United States Security Council when it's created. Similarly, these neutrals are absolutely fascinating and incredibly important, even if the word neutral doesn't sound very exciting. When Hermann Göring was in his cell prior to his execution at Nuremberg, his American interrogator asked him what he thought Hitler's greatest mistake was. And Göring did not reply the invasion of the Soviet Union, as you and I might say. He said that Hitler's greatest mistake was not invading Spain following the fall of France. And I think, while this may not have been Hitler's greatest mistake, that he certainly had a point. If the Germans had captured Spain, including the Rock of Gibraltar, they would have been able to close the Mediterranean to the British, and therefore the whole of North Africa, the Middle East, and Britain's imperial possessions thereafter, and many of its oil resources, are lost. So keeping Franco neutral was a very important diplomatic activity based on carrot and stick. And this most unlikely character, a reviled former foreign secretary, Sir Samuel Hoare, memorably described by Churchill's friend, the late Lord Birkenhead, as the last in a long line of maiden aunts, plays a really difficult hand with fantastic élan. And I think all of this has to be brought into the wider story because it informs how the big players see each other and see the post-war world and how the war evolves.
Yeah, as I recall it, after Hoare agreed to the Hoare-Laval Pact in the 30s, the UN cry was no more Hoares to France in the British press.
King George King George V actually said to Hoare at their resignation meeting, "You know what they're saying, no more coals to Newcastle, no more Hoares to Paris."
Right. So there you have it. But one of the things that, I mean, you do so well is to illuminate characters like the role of characters like Hoare and Philip Kerr, Lord Lothian, the UK's ambassador to the United States, who tragically dies very early and is replaced by Halifax, I think.
He's another fellow who had to be redeemed. This was a very curious, rather brilliant, but definitely quirky character who, in the 1930s, had convinced himself that he could negotiate with Hitler. And apart from Neville Chamberlain, he's one of the senior British figures who visits Hitler most in the 30s and then comes back to Britain and writes some extraordinarily naive articles about Hitler's desire for peace. And he was known in the Foreign Office at the time as Lord Loathsome. I think he and Halifax, who obviously was also tainted by appeasement, then became extremely successful, highly effective political appointment ambassadors to Washington.
Yeah, I mean, Halifax, as late as May of 1940, in the wake of the fall of France, is actually promoting the idea of reaching out and negotiating with Hitler based on feelers from the Italians. And Churchill lets him in the War Cabinet have his say. And in the end, the War Cabinet agrees not to pursue that, in part because Churchill is at that point backed by the Lord Privy Seal, as I recall, Neville Chamberlain, who has come to the conclusion that there's no more negotiating with Hitler. But all of these are fascinating characters, at the second tier, who play enormously important roles in all of this, and you do them justice. Could you talk a little bit about the effort to get? I mean, you talk about Sir Samuel Hoare's extremely successful effort to keep Spain out of the war, including use of sort of non-traditional diplomatic tools. Let me put it that way.
I think we can call it bribery. It's £4 million worth of bribes given to senior members of the Francoist regime by the British to keep them neutral. Whether or not it had any effect, we obviously don't know, because Franco didn't decide to join the war ultimately. So these people could not have the opportunity to argue him down. And if we look at Greece, we can see instances of Mussolini bribing several Greek generals, but that didn't stop the Greeks ejecting the Italians from Greece when the Italians invaded Greece in October of 1940.
Right. But talk a little bit about the less successful effort at the other end of the Mediterranean to try and get Turkey into the war.
Turkey, I think, is an instance of great wishful thinking and great Churchillian wishful thinking. After the United States and Spain, Turkey is easily the most important neutral country, a country which, if it could be persuaded to rally to the forces of the democracies, could form the central part of a Balkan front along with Yugoslavia and Greece. And there are various efforts to get the Turks into the war. But the Turks have absolutely no intention of wishing to join the war. They don't view it as a war that they wish to fight for ideological reasons, and certainly not a war that they wish to fight for strategic reasons. They have very little desire to have their cities pummeled to rubble, as had happened in Belgrade and to a certain extent in Athens in the summer of 1941, and they lead to the British a pretty merry dance. Some of the British, Anthony Eden, Alec Cadogan, are fairly clear, as is the British ambassador there, Sir Hugh Knatchbull Hugesson, that the Turks aren't coming into the war. But Churchill is so delighted by the warm reception he gets from the Turkish president when he meets him following the Casablanca conference, that he does allow himself to believe that the Turks are going to eventually come into the war. And as you and I know, they didn't.
We've talked a bit about the big three already, but you've talked about FDR's conviction that his personal charms can create a relationship with Stalin that will not only mitigate Soviet occupation of Eastern Europe, but also set the stage for a post-war international order in which you'll, I mean, he was a Wilsonian. He had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy in Woodrow Wilson's cabinet in the First World War, was the Democratic vice presidential nominee, in fact, in 1920, which lost the election to Warren Harding, and a decade of conservative Republican dominance in American politics. But despite being a Wilsonian and wanting to have a post-war international organization, the United Nations, which you adverted to earlier, Tim, in your comments, Roosevelt also was enough of a realist to believe that the post-war world was going to be dominated by the U.S., the U.K., and the Soviet Union. Now, you mentioned that Churchill insisted on the resurrection of France as a great power and its inclusion in the Security Council. I guess, you know, the analog for the U.S. side was FDR's conviction that China was going to be a great power in the post-war, and that Chiang Kai-shek was going to be a key player as well, and therefore the American assistance that China, and not just China, but nationalist China, get a seat in the Security Council. But Roosevelt really believes it's going to be the three big powers that are going to really call the shots. And so he makes this effort first at Tehran and then later at Yalta. And it's a point you make is this is an indication of Stalin's power and authority as a diplomat, that he makes Churchill and Roosevelt travel an awfully long way to meet him, first in Tehran and then on Soviet territory in the Crimea at Yalta. But talk a little bit about those two conferences at Tehran and Yalta. You've talked a little bit about it. And then give us your judgment. You have a very interesting judgment about how the Americans and the Brits did as diplomatists during the Second World War, which is not, I think, what the normal conventional wisdom has it.
Stalin did want something out of the Tehran conference, but he wasn't prepared to go very far to get it. Iran had been occupied by the British and the Soviets in August of 1941 to deny it to the Germans who had invaded the Soviet Union. So it wasn't a great danger for Stalin to visit there, and it wasn't very far for him to come, unlike the trips made by Churchill and even more Roosevelt. But at that conference, Stalin had one objective, and that was to get the British and the Americans to commit to a spring invasion of the main part of Western Europe, of France. And that he got. He got that by having the Americans line up with him and force a reluctant Churchill to agree that Operation Overlord would take place in May of 1944. It was subsequently delayed to June of 1944. By Yalta, which is reconquered Soviet territory, now technically Ukrainian territory, although it's once again being occupied by Russia in the Crimea, Stalin doesn't really need very much. He has certain objectives, such as reparations and a deal on prisoners of war, but it's the British and the Americans who wish to try and restrain him and his political plans for Eastern Europe. And they frankly don't have much success at all, because the Red Army is already in place. But the myth, which is so persistent, it's being talked about still now by particularly historians on the American right or members of the MAGA movement, and was a absolutely central plank of the 1950s Republican Party, was that the Americans and the British betrayed Eastern Europe at Yalta. And that is untrue. Firstly, I think Yalta has been exaggerated as a wartime summit. It didn't make a vast amount of difference to the world that came after. The facts were there on the ground, and the crucial decisions had already been made. They had been made in 1943, when the British and the Americans decided that they were going to invade Sicily and then Italy rather than attempt a cross-channel invasion. They had been made when Roosevelt had told the Soviet foreign minister and the Soviet ambassador to the United States that he recognized that the Soviet Union did deserve and would probably have a predominant interest in Eastern and Central Europe at the end of the war, but he couldn't give this official sanction for political reasons. So I don't think the Yalta Conference itself was as important as people have said, and therefore Roosevelt's illness, which was evident at Yalta, is even less relevant than it was. It is, should also be pointed out that, as Anthony Eden wrote in his memoirs, FDR's illness did not prevent him from conducting secret diplomacy with Stalin behind the back of his British allies to create a deal for Soviet involvement in the war against Japan, which saw Stalin rewarded with significant areas of territory in Far East Asia at the expense of his other ally, nationalist China, who was not represented there. So I think we need to move away from the idea of the Yalta myth and the betrayal. And we should also point out that although FDR did not give very good support to Churchill's efforts to preserve some form of democracy, some form of sovereign independence for Poland and for other areas of liberated Europe at Yalta, they nevertheless did get the Soviet Union to sign up to the Declaration for Liberated Europe, which promised democracy, sovereignty, and independence for all territories liberated by the Allies. And therefore, even if they couldn't actually enforce this, they were able to indict the Soviet Union before the world in the early years of the Cold War for having broken these Yalta Accords. So I think that that was an achievement, even if obviously from the perspective of the peoples of Eastern Europe and Central Europe, this was a Pyrrhic victory. Elsewhere, I think one can say an awful lot more positively about Allied or democratic diplomacy during the Second World War, but mistakes being made at Yalta, I think, have been exaggerated.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I think one could conclude is that the Declaration on Liberated Europe that was adopted at Yalta in some ways is the first articulation of the principles that underpin the Helsinki Accord 30 years later, and which ultimately lead, you know, to the liberation of Eastern Europe, you know, as the Cold War ends. We're running a bit short of time. I wonder if you have some thoughts, having written so extensively on the Allied diplomacy of the Second World War and about the difficult tasks of coalition maintenance and alliance management. If you see in this story that you've told so well any lessons for the contemporary world and the alliance structure that we have now, which seems to be under assault from within, at least in the United States, but also from without by Russia and the PRC and North Korea and Iran.
I think there are two clear lessons. The first is that allies and alliances should be treated with respect, if not actually with reverence. Alliances take a very, very long time to form, but minutes or days to shatter. And I think we take our traditional alliances in the West, alliances founded not just upon shared strategic and economic interests, but also ideological interests, a joint belief in democracy, in free markets, in the rule of law, in the rule of international law. We take this at our peril. And of course, alliances are infuriating. I've just written a whole book about how difficult alliances are to work and how infuriating allies can be. But I do just keep on coming back to the Winston Churchill line, which he said time and time again during the Second World War, which is that there is only one thing worse than fighting with allies, and that is fighting without allies. And everyone, no matter how powerful, needs allies. Isolationism is no cure. This was conclusively shown at Pearl Harbor, when the world was far less interconnected than it is now. Isolationism did not protect the United States of America. America joined the war in any case, and in retrospect, it would have, of course, been better if the United States had not retreated from the international order post the First World War and the Treaty of Versailles, but had played its part to contain revanchist, aggressive, totalitarian or militaristic states. The war, therefore, might have been avoided if the power of the US had been pitted on the side of peace and international agreements rather than leaving everything to the Europeans. And secondly, I would say, and this is a lesson which I take from both of my books, we have to understand regimes for what they are and have a proper understanding of who they are. Neville Chamberlain would not have appeased Hitler if he had understood that Hitler did not just want the Sudetenland of Czechoslovakia, but wanted all of Czechoslovakia and then Poland, and then was determined to create a new German empire in the center of Europe. He misunderstood Hitler. This led to one of the most famous diplomatic, political, strategic catastrophes of the modern era. And I think if we look back in retrospect, there is no particular reason why we should have been any more naive or should have ignored the very obvious actions of the Putin government, of the Xi government, or of the North Korean government, or whoever it may be. Most of our foes, most of those states or regimes which wish the democratic West ill, have either been saying so for years or have been acting in such a manner for a long time. And that's not a clarion call for widespread neoconservative regime change, to say something which may be controversial in America. I think that when I say we must understand the nature of the regime, this goes both ways, in this sense that misunderstanding regimes and getting the wrong historical analogy can lead to complete catastrophes, such as when Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal in 1956, Anthony Eden, who had been foreign secretary when Hitler remilitarized the Rhineland in 1936, thought, aha, this is another Hitler in Egypt. We must go in early. And it led to one of the greatest and most shameful aspects in British foreign policy history. Similarly, I feel that both the United States and the British made an appalling strategic error in somehow equating Saddam Hussein with Hitler. Of course, he was one of the most evil and abhorrent men in the world, but this was not a man who had the ability by 2003 to act in a Hitlerian scale or even in the same level of scale that he had acted during the first Gulf War. So we have to understand the nature of the regimes with which we are dealing with and not wish the mill. And if I was to, sorry, and not just rely on wishful thinking. And if I was going to say one final thing, based on the 30s, the way the war went, and how the West won the Cold War, we shouldn't just cling on to our alliances, but we should cherish the values which, maybe aggravatingly for some part of the world, but nevertheless rightly, allow ourselves to have and feel a certain sense of moral purpose about what it is that we do, and that it will become increasingly difficult to have any sort of political leverage or moral leverage or humanitarian leverage if we allow our own democratic institutions and our own hard-fought liberties to wither on the vine.
Well, Tim, that's a perfect sentiment on which to end this episode of Shield of the Republic. I'm very grateful for you taking the time to be with us today. And I commend Allies at War to all of our listeners and viewers. It's a great read, and it will repay you tenfold in your understanding of alliances, which, as my former boss, the late George Shultz, once said, require constant tending, like gardening. And you've given some great examples today of how that kind of gardening took place during World War II. So thank you so much, Tim.
Thank you, Eric. It's been a pleasure.